let us hear a few verses read from both the first and the second chapters of Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. These passages which I read, which I shall read, are really quotations or parts thereof of Old Testament passages. The first is from the first chapter, 18th and 19th verses. Now the preaching of the cross is to those who are perishing just foolishness. But to those of us who are being saved, it is God's power. For it is written, and this is the quotation, I will utterly destroy the wisdom of wise people and brush aside the understanding of the intelligentsia. And then the second passage is from the last verse of the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, where the apostle says, For of him are you in Christ Jesus, who became wisdom for us from God. That is, Jesus Christ became wisdom for us from God. He became our right standing, our sanctification, and our complete redemption, just as it is written, and this is the quotation, Whoever rejoices, let him rejoice only in the Lord. And then, over in the second chapter, in the ninth verse, or thereabouts, I better start reading, let me read from the sixth verse. I hate to read in the middle of a sentence. The ninth verse. Now we are speaking about a wisdom to mature Christians, but it is not a wisdom that this world speaks of, nor is it a wisdom which the rulers of this world seem to know anything about. But we are speaking a wisdom in a mystery, that is, that has been especially revealed to us, which was hidden formerly, but which God has made known to us for our glory, which the rulers of this world really did not understand. For if they had thoroughly understood, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory, just as it is written. And this is the quotation. The eye has not seen, nor has the ear heard, nor has it even begun to enter into the heart of a man, those things that God has prepared for him, for them who love him. And one more quotation from the last verse of the second chapter. And this is the 16th verse. For, and this is a quotation, who really knows the mind of the Lord? Or who has ever been able to give him advice? But we Christians do know the mind of Christ. Now, as I indicated in the bulletin this morning, The subject of this thing is Paul's use of the Old Testament in 1 Corinthians. Paul's use of the Old Testament in 1 Corinthians. The first quotation was from the first chapter in the 19th verse. I will destroy utterly the wisdom of the wise, and will brush aside the understanding of, really, I noticed that a good dictionary, it says smart-aleck for a modern term. The understanding of the intelligentsia, the know-it-alls. I will brush it aside. Now, in order to get the proper setting, so that I will not have to stop so-called preaching, I want to call your attention to the original Old Testament setting, and this is from Isaiah 29. Therefore, and this is the passage from which Paul was quoting when he says, I will brush aside the understanding of wise people. I will proceed to do a marvelous work among you. For I will see to it that the wisdom of the wise men shall utterly perish, and the understanding of their prudent people shall be utterly vain. Now, Paul quotes that passage from Isaiah 29, in which passage Isaiah is showing the spiritual stupor of the children of Israel. And Paul is doing the same thing in Corinth. His reason in quoting these passages is to show that the workings of God are according to wisdom and truth and grace, though they may not meet with the approval, the intellectual approval of mankind. And I do not want to go into all of the details and possible ramifications of this text, except to remind you that we are guilty of perhaps making the same mistake in a slightly different way that some of the Israelites did to whom Isaiah wrote, and some of the Corinthians did to whom Paul wrote. They were in their hearts and minds questioning some of the activities that went on, as they call them, God's dealings. They questioned history as whether God was really in control or not. They would, with their lips in the temple, say, we trust God and we believe that He's working out things for our good. And yet, when certain things happened military-wise and otherwise to their defeat and dismay and chagrin, they began to say, when I look at it, we believe that we have a wrong picture of God. We don't believe God was able to do anything about this. And He didn't show Himself a very wise God or a very powerful one when He allowed this to happen. See, we're still talking about wisdom and power. For example, sometimes we feel that in the providence of God, things happen to us which we believe ought not to happen. We'll say, if God really loves us, why then did He let this happen? Do you notice that phrase? Why did God let this happen to me? And I tell you, my friends, this is dangerous questioning. It's dangerous for a number of reasons, the most important of which is that it challenges the wisdom of God and His power. It also is an index of our lack of trust and faith in His goodness. But men have from time immemorial been disposed to say, well, our way is best, and we'll do it our way. One of the classic illustrations that I've called your attention before of men's wisdom being flouted in the face of God's power and wisdom was in the case of the well-known ship Titanic that went down in the Atlantic long before most of you had arrived on terra firma to know anything about it. about in April 1912, here's this great luxury liner, and indeed it was a luxury liner, built by the best minds of maritime engineering that the world could provide in those days, with airtight compartments on either side of that great ship, which were designed to keep that ship afloat no matter what struck her or what she struck. And that was the bragging slogan of her manufacture, of her construction, of her, the ones who made her. Not even God can sink this ship. God's power cannot send this ship to the bottom. Man's intellect and power has seen to that. We have made airtight compartments so that even if the side of this ship is blown off, these airtight compartments will keep her afloat. But in spite of the fact that while that ship was making her maiden voyage from England to New York, liners going in the opposite direction from west to east, having passed through the iceberg area and having seen several of them, warned the captain of the Titanic, you better slow down, there are icebergs ahead. The only two volumes that I've read about the Titanic, in both of them, the captain is reported to have roared back, icebergs? Why, not even God can sink this ship 4 feet ahead. And just shortly thereafter, those who were having a wonderful time, and I'm not against having a wonderful time, some were eating and drinking and playing cards and what have you in the ballroom of that luxury liner, heard about 10 o'clock that night a strange rumbling sound, and the motors became strangely silent. And in less than 3 hours, that great ship, with a great number of her passengers, was lying on the bottom of cold North Atlantic water. One of God's little icebergs got in the way and ripped those airtight compartments to pieces. It's a very crude illustration, but it just simply goes to show you that even the sum of man's knowledge cannot begin to equal the knowledge of the Almighty. And sometimes that passage in the 14th of Isaiah that is sometimes quoted as biblical support for the fact that Satan had his origin in heaven and was kicked down actually is talking about, of course, the commander-in-chief of the Babylonian forces who was making his way toward Jerusalem. And he made his way proudly as the makers of the Titanic did. Not even God can sink this ship. And when Sennacherib said that he was going to destroy Israel, Isaiah said, oh no, not Jerusalem. You'll never take it. The Lord has told me that you'll never get into this city. And Sennacherib said, well now, who is this Lord? Where does he live? And Isaiah said, why, Yahweh is the Lord and he lives in heaven. And Sennacherib says, I'll just go up to heaven and kick him down. And that's when Isaiah writes that marvelous dirge over the fall of the king of Babylon. Oh yes, you will, eh? You'll be the one to be kicked down, and what a fall it's going to be. And what a pity so many people talk about Satan being kicked out of heaven. You're not talking about a thing except old Sennacherib, who got right outside Jerusalem, all right? God taunted that old bugger. He let him get just right outside the city. He'd already taken Lachish, but let him get right outside the gates of the city. And he warned the people in Jerusalem, if you don't give up by tomorrow, I'm coming in. And that night, 185,000 of their men were dead as doornails. Apparently, from bubonic plague, Herodotus tells us about the plague of mice, rats, and all been eaten on their boots and straps and so on. What I'm driving at is, man proposes, God disposes. With all of man's mighty plans, God is the one whose wisdom encompasses all of the plans of man. And Napoleon had to learn the hard way too. And his insistence on conquering Russia says, nothing's going to stop me. The Russians sent their ambassador, who must have been something of a Christian. I forget what his name was. He pleaded with Napoleon. What good's it going to do you? We're willing to talk with you. Why risk having thousands of your men killed, thousands of our men killed, innocent men, women, and children slaughtered, when we can sit down around the table and talk this thing over? Napoleon says, nothing can stop me from going to Moscow. I'm going. And you remember he set out for Moscow. And instead of letting icebergs get in the way as he did in the Titanic and the little invisible bacillus or virus of bubonic plague, as in the case of Sennacherib, he let his little snowflakes come down. And they came down too early, too fast, too many. And there was Napoleon and his army simply destroyed there on the steps of Russia. Of course, it's obvious to us what this is saying. And this is precisely what Isaiah was saying and precisely what Paul is saying. That we dare not challenge the power of God and the wisdom of God in his providential dealings with his people. In the next section, we notice in 131, he who rejoices, let him rejoice only in the Lord. Where the Corinthians were apparently showing some signs of bragging that whatever salvation they needed, they could provide it pretty well, thank you. And Paul says, no, indeed you cannot. Not except you come to Jesus Christ. And so the apostle quotes a passage from Jeremiah. He that glories, be sure you glory in the Lord Yahweh. He is the one who can save you. And I'd say that this too is an important truth for us. In our day and time, there are many people who are putting their trust, their hope of being right with God on who they are and what they've done. And my, what slender thread they lean on. Who they are and what they've done. The only sure way, and this is an example of God's wisdom and power, is to come to Jesus Christ. He that glory, let him glory in the Lord. But quickly now, the next quotation is a little misleading, and it's been oftentimes misapplied. In the second chapter, the eye hath not seen, the ear hath not heard what things God has prepared for those who love him. And too often this is a passage quoted as referring specifically to heaven. And in a sense, yes. But actually in the context, and in the context of Isaiah 64, where hence it is quoted, it's actually telling us that great biblical principle that spiritual things are spiritually discerned. And I want to try to drive this home to us just a little while. We cannot understand the things of the Spirit, the things that the Bible teaches, unless we come to the Bible in a spiritual attitude. But all the number of people who go to it critically to see what it is they can agree with, what it is they can like, what it is they can accept, the Bible is not for that. The Bible is never in, we are never in a position to sit in judgment on it and go to it critically in that sense of the word. One of the reviews that Dr. Donald Miller wrote of a review of the fourth gospel, I forget the name of that gentleman who wrote the commentary, but the commentary did in part show a great deal of arrogance on the part of the writer. He said that John showed poor judgment and saying this and poor judgment and doing this, and he was utterly mistaken in doing this and utterly mistaken in doing that. When I saw that Dr. Miller was reviewing it, I knew that Dr. Miller wouldn't like that kind of business. And his last statement in the review was, quote, "This reviewer found some interesting insights in the commentary, but must say that he is getting good and tired of the critical view, critical approach to the Bible. It is high time," he says, "that we recognize that we are in no position to sit in judgment on the Bible. And the critics have got to learn to sit back quietly now and let the Bible sit in judgment on them." That's what this text is really driving at. Spiritual things are spiritually discerned. Let me just quote one passage that Jesus used to say the same thing. In the 11th of Matthew, the scribes and Pharisees were doing the same kind of, showing the same kind of arrogance. And the text says, "At that hour, Jesus says, 'I thank you, Father, that thou hast hidden these things, the truths of the gospel, from the wise and the prudent.'" Notice, both Isaiah and Paul said they're going to be thrown aside anyhow by God. "That thou hast hidden these things from the wise and the prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. For this seemed right in your sight, Father." And I commend it to you, my friends, let us not yield to the temptation of approaching the Bible critically. Yes, approach it with questions, seekingly, but never approach it in an arrogant way, as if you know better than what's written there. Invariably, if you will approach it seeking the truth, the Holy Spirit can use the text and reveal the truth to you. And oh my, these critics who have said that we don't know a thing about what Jesus said or did because the text that we have in the New Testament of the Gospels were not written until 140 or 150 A.D., and Jesus was dead, and Paul was dead, and John was dead, and all that we write, all that we read was some concoction that people have put together. Now, of course, the archaeologists spade in the new manuscript discoveries and a lot of other linguistic elements have come to show that without the shadow of a doubt, these texts of the New Testament are all early documents, and all of them definitely written before A.D. 70, some of them written as early as perhaps 50, A.D. 50. That's 100 years before 150. Dr. Rudolf Bultmann, his well-known demythologizer. We've got the demythologizer. We've got to strip the myth out of the New Testament. So much myth and stuff that's in there that doesn't, is not truth at all. Let us get all of that out there, and then we'll... First year out at the seminary, I had to read The Quest of the Historical Jesus by Albert Schweitzer. A long book, a thick book, and long too, but that's it. The Quest of the Historical Jesus. And all the countless hours I spent sweating with that book, and, well, I started to say cussing, but I think maybe I did, excuse me, but I'm telling you the truth. It was an awful book. Schweitzer was questing for Jesus, looking for Jesus. Never did find him. said, we can't find him. We don't know anything about Jesus. Yeah. This man that the gospel writers tell us about, why, he's not so. Why? No. Myth. Well, the understanding of the prudent and spiritual things, they are perceived only by people who have a spiritual intent as they read the Bible. One final word. In the second chapter, the last verse, or next to the last verse, we find this text about God's sovereignty in His being. Who has ever advised God about anything? Do you remember that text? Who has ever been His counselor? And this is what both Isaiah and Paul were driving at. The people were acting as if to say, why, God didn't ask me about this. He should have inquired about my knowledge to get my ideas to how to do this or how to do that. And the text is simply saying that God has never had to ask anybody as to whether He's done the right thing or not, because He always does right. And for us Christians, we need to remember this. So many little things in our lives that we are apt to question. And we question whether God is behind it or whether He's not behind it, whether it's happened apart from Him, or whether things got loose from Him and out from under His control, or whether He's really in control and He hasn't had the last word about it yet. That's what we've got to remember. God does not pay off every Saturday night. Remember that. And events which can crush us this moment, if we can somehow by God's grace be patient and wait, He can oftentimes bring it to where we see that He knew exactly what He was doing, and He was doing things for our good. Hard to believe, hard to accept, but true. I'd like to close by calling your attention to a couple of verses from a hymn that I think are apropos. I don't know who wrote this either, but it doesn't make any difference. I trace your lines of argument, your logic, linked and strong. I weigh as one who dreads dissent and fears a doubt as wrong. I know not what the future hath of marvel or surprise, assured alone that life and death His mercy underlies. Oh, I do know this is a Mr. Whittier. And so beside the silent sea I wait the muffled oar. No harm can come to him or me. from him to you or me, on ocean or on shore. I know not where his islands lift their fronded palms in air. I only know I cannot drift beyond his love and care. Not now, but in the coming years, it may be in the better land we'll read the meaning of our tears, and then sometime we'll understand. We'll know why clouds instead of sun were over many a cherished plan, why song had ceased when scarce begun. Yes, there, sometime we'll understand. God knows the way. He holds the key. He guides us with unerring hand. Sometime, with tearless eyes, we'll see. Yes, there. Up there. We'll understand. Who has ever been the counselor for the Lord? So let us trust him, knowing as the apostle did that God is constantly working everything out. Everything out. For our good. To those who love him.